General Downward, Reel 2. I think you were telling me about the briefing system.
That's right, yes. I try and get other speakers to come down and brief them on events, people coming down from divisional headquarters, but I'd also use the opportunity, if we had visitors out from UK or even Hong Kong, for them to tell us what was happening in other theatres, particularly, of course, what was happening back in UK. Soldiers were always interested to know what was happening in their own sort of home areas or in sort of any sort of governmental decisions in this country and what was happening, and more particularly concerned to know, of course, what their own sort of prospects were for going home and when they were going to go home, whether the war was going to, the end of the war was in sight. And I think that the greatest boost we used to have was, and we had it happened quite a few times, was to have correspondents coming out from home areas, usually covering perhaps a group of newspapers, either from Manchester or Liverpool or any of the big cities or London, quite often to get local boy stories and write them up and take photographs. And this, of course, was very good from the point of view of the next of kin back in UK. But it was also a very good opportunity to get these chaps to brief my soldiers and airmen on what was happening in England. And we also, of course, had a very good sort of newspaper which came up with all the sort of snippets of news. If I remember rightly, it was called the Crown newspaper, because that, of course, was the sign of the Commonwealth Division. But that was well read and was always eagerly sought by the soldiers as soon as the thing arrived.
Were they aware, do you think, of the scale of Atherton Carrera, of the wide range of countries that were actually engaged?
No. I don't believe many of the officers even knew quite the sort of scale of the participation and what really made up the United Nations force. I became aware of it perhaps more so by being able to fly from one side of the front to the other, particularly in the liaison role, flying perhaps the divisional commander or one of the staff officers over to another part of the front. And then one would see various other nationalities that one had no idea that were there in the first place. I remember sort of coming across the Turks. I knew that there was a Turkish participation, but I'd never realised what a very strong force they were and what a very formidable force they were too. But they were more towards the central front.
Bearing all these political considerations in mind, what was the mood of the flight when it embarked for the sea journey to the Far East?
Most of them were young soldiers and had not had overseas experience of any sort. There were one or two regulars, as I mentioned, who, of course, were the old sort of India Wallahs. The staff sergeant we had was a chap who was well experienced in some overseas service. And I think for most of them, it was a great adventure getting on the boat at Southampton and eventually going out into the Mediterranean and then down through the Red Sea. It was a tremendous adventure for them. And it was also a gradual feed-in, seeing new countries, gradually acclimatising. But I suppose at that time we were pretty near to the end of the troop shipping, the trooping role by troop ships. And it wasn't a terribly pleasant experience for them, being below decks in fairly cramped accommodation. But, of course, it was nothing compared with sort of the trooping which went on during the wartime years, where one always had to sleep with one's life jackets sort of fastened to one, or sort of near at hand, and one was always under the threat of being torpedoed somewhere on the high sea and having to make sort of a quick exit up onto the top deck. We did have fire drills, and we had some various briefings. There was always plenty of time for briefings and a certain amount of recreation. We stopped at various ports of call. So it was a gradual transition from a UK environment to a wartime environment in the Far East. And even when we got to our almost to the final destination, we went to Japan, we offloaded at Kure, we then moved down to Iwakuni, which was only about 20-odd miles away from Kure, put our aircraft together there, and then carried out flight testing and further tactical training, really sort of shakedown training, getting all our equipment working really and making sure that everything, that pilots, crews and equipment all worked properly before flying them over to Korea. So we were in Japan for about another month even before we actually set foot on Korean soil.
Was it your first visit to Japan?
Yes, it was. Yes. I hadn't been to Japan before. The farthest east I'd been before was to Singapore and Hong Kong. I'd been to Hong Kong. But to actually visit Japan was a completely new experience for all of us. And it was interesting, it was fascinating, and particularly as we were very close to Hiroshima. Iwakuni was only about 7 or 8 miles away from Hiroshima. It was interesting to see that, because that was obviously very much a name known to all our soldiers at that time as a result of the atom bomb.
How did they adjust to being in a Far Eastern country on a day-to-day basis?
I think that the main adjustment, of course, is really sort of understanding the language, or, as so often happens with soldiers, they rather expect other people to understand their language. But nevertheless, we got by all right in sort of shops and in bartering and sort of certain amount of arm waving and shouting, I suppose, that people got by all right. There wasn't a great deal of traffic on the roads at that time in Japan, and it wasn't too difficult, in fact, to get from Iwakuni, say, to Kure or various other places by road. The Japanese rail service was very effective too, with no great difficulty there at all. Going to Korea was somewhat different, and this was a certain, I think to most of them, was a bit of a rude awakening. They went straight into tents down at Busan in the transit area there, and the element of war was very clear at that time. Everywhere you went, there were large numbers of military vehicles, mainly sort of American in the Busan area, but many other nationalities milling around as well. Everything, our food, our clothing, and practically every other sort of commodity was stamped in some way, whether sort of a military marking. Everything was fed to us through the sort of the normal sort of supply lines. One was aware of the fact that one was no longer living amongst civilians, one was very much amongst a military environment. Driving on roads became even more of a problem. The roads were extremely bad. All the way up north, all the vehicles had to be driven from South Korea, from Busan, right up to the Ford area. Roads were extremely bad. And, of course, one was aware that all the route signing was under military police guidance, and I remember my own impression of it. I didn't actually go to Busan. I flew my aircraft straight up to Seoul, and then from there moved forward to the forward strip. But I had already carried out a reconnaissance before the main part of the flight arrived. And the one thing which struck me as soon as I arrived there, I was met at the airfield and driven by jeep up to to the forward area. And it all came back to me, so the scenes of the last war, all sort of the masses of route signing, various of arrows, code names, symbols, all pointing out the difference of units and different formations, masses of telephone lines along the road, signalers carrying out repairs, sappers bulldozing the roads. It was something for me which really sort of went back. Admittedly, it was only about 6 years, turning back to the end of the last of the 39-45 war. But it all suddenly came back to me that it was something very familiar to me as having had a bit of war experience, although obviously the terrain was somewhat different to that of northwest Germany. But for the ordinary soldiers and airmen coming out there, I think it was quite a shock to see what war conditions were really like and to live firsthand, under the threat of, fire, particularly artillery and mortar fire up in the forward area.
How long did it take them to actually settle down and get used to it and
work? Oh, very, very quickly. We were fortunate enough to arrive in some good weather conditions. It was in September, beginning of September 1951 when we arrived there, and it was still quite hot. We were in shirt sleeve order, and I think it was difficult for most of us to visualize just how cold it was going to become in the winter months. But it did enable us to move in quite quickly, to more or less dig ourselves in, set up sort of shelters and structures, tents, as I mentioned, were the first type of accommodation we arranged. But the biggest lesson I think the soldiers learned, possibly more so than the airmen, was really how to improvise. Picking up old bits of wood from packing cases, corrugated iron, sandbags, bits of canvas, all these things went into making sort of huts, and they made themselves very comfortable indeed. and learned how to make sort of space heaters. Unfortunately, these weren't always terribly reliable, certainly not the homemade ones, and we did have one or two fires, and kit was burnt. But this was, I'm afraid, was the penalty for trying to keep our chaps warm in the winter months. By the time the winter came, they were well and truly acclimatised and well and truly settled into the sort of the area. The main danger was that, and this went for all the units in Korea, I think that people became so well entrenched in their own particular area that if ever we'd been told, right, pick up everything and move and get back, we're going back to another line further back, or even to move forward, we could not have taken even half the stuff with us because we'd acquired so much extra clobber, which the soldiers would have been very reluctant to do away with, things like sort of camp beds or beds they'd made and sort of space heaters they'd made, all these sort of things. They'd managed to acquire quite a few luxuries, and life became tolerable. And in fact, for some, I think it was almost quite enjoyable, particularly in the summer months.
Now, I think when you were arriving, the Commonwealth Division had just been formed up. Who was actually in charge of you and your flight?
We came under directly under divisional headquarters, and we came under the hand of the G1. So he was my boss. If I had a report on anything at all, either operationally or administratively, I would usually go straight to the G1, who would then either hand me on to somebody on the administrative side if it was to do with something regarding replacements or demand and supply to do with the aircraft or the actual military equipment. But the G1 was the person who set the task. And when I first went there, he was a Canadian G1, and he said, well, I'm not too sure of quite how we're going to use you yet. You know that the divisional commander, General Castles, wants to use you in much the same way as the Americans use their aircraft, as of general purpose for sort of flying staff officers around and also carrying out a certain amount of reconnaissance on both sides of the line, because quite often we have to look at ground our side of the line as well. I'd like you to give thought to this before you actually go and speak with the divisional commander. So eventually, when I went to see General Jim Castles, I'd already made out my own sort of ideas of what I wanted to do, and that was that I didn't want the flight to be entirely as of an air taxi firm. I wanted it to take part in reconnaissance, which we built up fairly quickly, and we became quite effective in that role because we were able to do tasks which the gunners had been rather reluctant to do. Their task was to shoot the guns, and if they were asked to go and divert from a particular mission to go and look at a grid reference, say, over one side of the front or the other, or even back behind the line, it obviously broke up the sequence of their shoot. And their task was entirely gun. Once we arrived, they were able to devote their efforts entirely to gunnery, and we would then do the other types of reconnaissance tasks. We actually did also build up a certain amount of experience in the AOP role. If we saw an opportunity target and there wasn't an AOP aircraft up there, we would then call down to switch our frequency, call down to the area, to the gunner control, give them the target grid reference and direct the guns. But that was usually only as a last resort. We would only do that if we saw a target and there wasn't a gunner airborne at the same time.
It sounds like you had to actually learn on the job.
Yes, it was. I spent 18 months there in Korea altogether, and I became so familiar with that particular part of the front, in other words, the Commonwealth Division front, ranging right down from, I think it was one of the American, possibly the American 2nd Division on our right, to the American Marine Division on the left, the whole of the front, I became very familiar with, right back to a depth of about 3 or 4 miles on the enemy side. And eventually I was given the appointment, quite unofficially, I think, but it was published in orders, that I was called the Divisional Air Reconnaissance Officer, which really meant that I would come and sort of brief the staff on aerial photographs and maps and giving them recent developments of what I was seeing over the other side. And I used to always make a point of doing at least one observation flight myself a day, probably running to about 2 hours, again depending on sort of what the mission was, but would spend about 2 hours airborne observing the front and reporting back. And I was able to do it fairly well just by the sort of feel of the area. I could tell when some new ground had been dug, if there was any movement going on, if anything had moved on the front, which perhaps maybe some vehicle tracks and things like that. I knew it as well as that, that I could more or less remember grid references, and even now I can still remember some of those grid references in my own mind, which were sort of points of particular interest to us. Also, of course, to be able to update update the photographs and the maps.
What were the maps like? Were they good quality?
They were. They were very good, actually. I think we had about two or three different series which came out, or different three reprints which came out while we were there. But these were obviously all based on aerial photography, which was carried out by the Americans. And certainly in the forward areas, the maps were good. They were American maps. They were made up by the American Survey Department, and I found them accurate and certainly very useful and very easy to fly by in our forward areas. I wouldn't say that high-speed aircraft could fly by them because it's a different type of map you require. Otherwise, I mean, you fly over sort of a map of the quarter-inch scale or four miles to the inch. Of course, you're off the end of the map in no time. But for our type of work, the maps which we had, which were the same maps being used by the ground troops, it was extremely effective.
Was your reconnaissance done primarily by photograph or by observation and memory, or did you go in for making sketches when actually in the air?
I suppose it was a combination, really, of various of methods. Eventually, when I felt that I was able to run the thing properly as a reconnaissance flight, I evolved a system with my own pilots and more or less made them follow the same sort of technique which I did. And that was, take for example, if you had an officer from one of the forward areas who was going to go out on a patrol, and this was something which happened fairly frequently, and the best way that he could see the ground was to come up with us and to fly in the back of the Auster and see that particular piece of ground. Now, what I used to do was to take the chap on one side. And he was nearly always an infantry officer. Occasionally he would have the odds of sapper who was going out to look for minefields and so forth, but it was on the infantry side. Being an infantry officer myself, I knew pretty well the sort of things he was looking for and what he was told to look for and what his mission was going to be. But I'd get him to explain exactly what his mission was, give me the sort of the area he was going to look at. We would then look at it on the map, turn up the aerial photographs. I would then sort of draw the China graph on the photographs, exactly the area that he was concerned with. I would then tell him that when we get here, get up to a height of about 5,000 feet, initially anyway, to get a good overall view, I would then sort of brief him again and point it out, because it was amazing the number of people who would come up in the back of an aircraft, and I suppose even so, exact the same with most of us, even when I first started. It was very difficult to orientate myself, particularly when there was no sun and the air was the sky was just dark and grey and dull and there were very few features round about, that you had to make sure that your passenger knew exactly what he was looking at on the ground. So having sort of briefed him, first of all, with the map, with the photographs, questioned him thoroughly as to what his mission was, I would then take him up and, having reached a height of 5,000, I would then sort of fly parallel to the sort of his objective and would then say, right, look out down there, pointing down to him, and say, see large feature, bald top, shell holes, go 6 o'clock down towards the river, line of barbed wire entanglement. That is this feature here on the aerial photograph, pointed out when I'd drawn. That feature with the sort of with a few trees and the broken trees and the sort of a wrecked hut, that is that feature there on the aerial photograph, and completely orientate him. Right, look at that. I will fly back to this in a moment. So get him to look at it. Bring him back again a second time. We'd then get him to use binoculars if we could. Fly him up and down several times doing this, but never concentrating on the point so much that ground observers would realize what we were looking at. Go past it, fly back, and do exactly the same again each time, until eventually the chap was thoroughly briefed on it and was thoroughly familiar with it from that height. And we then fly back to our own side of the line and then say, right, have you got everything you want? Have you marked up your map? Have you marked up your aerial photographs? And have you got all the ideas that you want? Did you notice, when you were flying, did you notice the barbed wire entanglement running along behind the paddy field, which are obviously defences? Did you notice the new digging, which had gone into a position, which I just noticed perhaps, some new digging further north of that, on the side of that slope? That looks to me as though there might be defensive positions there. No, I didn't. Take him back again and thoroughly drive it into him, bring him back there, and eventually, when he was reasonably satisfied, bring him back and land him, and then go through it again and make sure he'd written it all down. I felt, although I was only a captain at the time, I felt very much responsible for these poor young men, uses of National Service lieutenants, going out to do a reconnaissance on ground which was hostile in the first place, quite apart from what they were going to meet at the end of their mission, or might meet at the end of the mission if they were going out on a fighting patrol, although most of them were really going out to do reconnaissance. But I hoped, in fact, that I was able to contribute to the infantry's task, or the ground forces task, in this particular type of reconnaissance. But that was really sort of the briefing of chaps going out on the ground and wanting to see ground in front of their positions. Sometimes commanding officers would come up with me, particularly if a unit had just arrived and was about to sort of move into the line, would probably be in reserve and would be coming up in 2 or 3 days. I would take the commanding officer up and show him the whole of the area, but would perhaps not go quite so much into detail, because obviously his own particular staff would brief him, and it was very much a case of feeling his way into the situation. But we did feel we could contribute quite a lot to the forward ground forces. Sappers, a role we developed there as well, which I think was quite useful to the sappers, particularly at the time of the thaw, at the end of the winter. Airstrips, roads, defences, everything became very, very soggy. It was the ice underneath forcing the sort of the water up. As it melted, as the ice melted, water would come up through this very porous ground, and the roads became absolutely impassable in some places. They were really very, very difficult, and the sappers had a full-time task maintaining, I'm not sure the mileage of roads, but I think in the Commonwealth Division it was something like about 600 miles of roads which were had to be maintained with a certain amount of metalling, and maintained for sort of with two sort of carriageways, one up, one down, for sort of vehicles using those areas. And for sappers to do it by road usually required two officers working in completely different sectors, two officers with their own sort of vehicles, probably taking anything up to about 4 or 5 days marking all the bad spots. I could cover the whole of the divisional area with one officer in the back, covering all the roads, in the course of perhaps 2 hours, or perhaps a couple of flights anyway. But that was a much more effective way of doing it, and the chap would mark up his map with the bad areas, would then perhaps send his own staff out, or NCOs out, to go and look at that particular spot on the ground, and make a recommendation as to what was required in the way of repairs. So reconnaissance and advice on reconnaissance was both sides of the line, forward and rear.
It sounds as though your principle of briefing was to tell the young officer who was going to go on the patrol the same thing about 6 different times in slightly different ways.
Yes. Yes, it was. I think my sympathy was really sort of twofold. First of all, that I understood his position as an infantry officer. And I remember only too well some of my rather hair-raising experiences in Holland and also in the Ardennes before that on patrol, which I found was really quite frightening. It was something which was far worse than really going into action, I think, with dozens of troops all around you, when you were alone in the dark, perhaps with 3 or 4 chaps around you who you were responsible for, not sure exactly where you were going, not sure where the enemy was, and knowing that the death could suddenly descend on you at any moment. It was not a very pleasant experience. It was a very frightening experience, and I felt for the young chap in that way. But secondly, I also appreciated as a pilot how difficult it could be for a chap flying in the back of an aeroplane. In most cases, people wouldn't admit they didn't know where they were. And this is quite a common thing with people flying in reconnaissance aircraft. And I've quickly learned this, and I made sure all my pilots questioned their passengers on it to make quite sure the chap knew where he was. Sometimes he would think he knew where he was, but he might be have an entirely different grid reference and be completely off target. So that was the first thing, really, was to make sure, A, I knew what the chap wanted to do when he was on the ground, and secondly, that he knew where he was when he was actually airborne with me at 5,000 feet. And sometimes, if I could, I'd bring him down lower so he could see the thing obliquely.
Now, the Chinese Army has a reputation for being very good at concealing itself from aerial reconnaissance, and yet you seem to have been able to spot signs of activity, new defences.
With the Koreans, the North Koreans and Chinese?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, this is so. I think the biggest factor there was that they had very few vehicles. You could look southwards from the forward positions and look at the Commonwealth Division and the other divisions too. There were masses of vehicles everywhere. That was the biggest giveaway, movement of vehicles. Tents and other constructions were quite unashamedly sort of exposed in certain areas. People just didn't worry because there wasn't the threat from the other side. But the Chinese and the North Koreans definitely knew they were under observation, particularly from aerial reconnaissance such as ourselves, and took very great measures to ensure that they were not spotted. Tracks, occasionally I would notice that there were vehicle marks on the roads, but they were, I think that the vehicle movement was very, very slight. But the one place which I remember I used to watch very closely was a ford in a bit of a river which came down to the Samichon, and I could always tell whether vehicles had been through there at night, because the one thing they couldn't eliminate were the sort of marks, the wet marks coming out of the river. And quite often you could see the marks actually on the bottom of the river too, where they'd had vehicles go across. You would certainly see them in the morning, first thing in the morning. They would come out of their dugouts on the rearward slopes, and they were just like ants coming out, and every chap would light up his own individual stove, I suppose, and cook up rice, or whatever it was, a sock full of rice, and cook up some food. But you would see a whole necklace of fires along the sort of the little flames along the rear slopes of the defensive positions. And these were the sort of the Chinese coming out and cooking up their breakfast. Next would follow things like sort of mats, rattan maps, or mats and like eiderdowns, quilts and things like that, which they'd bring out for a brief bit of airing. But 1 hour after daylight, the whole lot had gone in again. So the time we used to concentrate on was usually first light in the morning, when you would see a certain amount of activity, and last thing at night, when, if there was going to be an attack, that would be the time you'd start to see certain movement, people coming up in the very rear areas, coming up to various sort of concentration points, ready for an attack during the night. So we used to concentrate early morning and last thing at night.
Did they respond when you flew over them in the early morning?
Initially, no. The way they would respond would be to take cover. And if they thought they were being watched, they would also get under cover, and obviously it could still see us, but they would take no sort of retaliatory action. There was no fire, although we were told by the ground troops, our own sort of forces in the forward areas, that they would fire back with small arms fire, but obviously we were high enough for us not to hear it, and certainly were not aware of it at all. But later they started to bring in 0.5 machine guns, and these could be unpleasant. You would certainly hear them, and what was more unpleasant was seeing the tracer arcing towards you. And then later you would start to get the 37mm anti-aircraft gun, something similar to the Bofors, and that, the first thing you would know would be a sort of a large sort of black puff fairly near you, and then you really had to take fairly violent evasive action. So towards the end, whereas initially we were flying 3 and 4 miles inside the enemy line, towards the end of our time we just couldn't go more than about half a mile back. In other words, we really wanted to be within gliding distance of our own line in case we were put out of action.
Did you lose anybody to ground
fire? Yes, we did. The gunners lost one chap killed on the enemy side of the strip, on the enemy side of the line, and another chap, in fact, who was shot down, but did manage to sort of make our side of the line, but crashed. He was completely whole. He wasn't actually injured, and he was completely